An official day of mourning had been declared for the late Colonel Hartman Srinivasan de Blakey. As a gesture of respect toward this primal Mercurian pioneer, his mourning period occupied an entire Mercurian day. Colonel de Blakey had been an ardent calendar reformer. To thoroughly break all cultural ties with Earth, de Blakey had struggled to reform the Mercurian pioneer habits around the 88-day Mercurian year and the 58-day Mercurian day. Of course, de Blakey's elaborate, ingenious calendar scheme had proven entirely hopeless in practice. Human beings had innate 24-hour biological cycles, so the practical habits within a sunless subterranean city had quickly assumed the modern workday system of 3 8-hour shifts. But de Blakey had never surrendered his cultural convictions about calendar reform. Just as he had fought valiantly for spelling reform, gender relations, and trinary computation, de Blakey had been an intellectual titan of Mercury. In acknowledgement of his legacy, it was agreed that gentlemen would wear their mourning veils for one entire Mercurian day. Being a mere boy of 8, Pitar's son Mario Luis Peretz wore only a light scarf, rather than the full male facial veil. Mario had his mother's good looks. Mario was a fine boy, a decent boy, a source of proper pride. Life in his juvenile creche was entirely ruled by women. So Mario had refined and dainty habits, long hair, painted fingernails, a skirt rather than trousers, everything as it should be. Through his mother's gene line, young Mario was closely related to the late Colonel de Blakey, so it was proper of Mario to attend the all-male obsequies up on the planet's surface. Of course, Pitar had to accompany his son as his paternal escort. The blistering, airless surface of Mercury was tremendously hostile and dangerous. It was therefore entirely proper for children. Pitar hadn't worn his spacesuit in 2 years, not since the last celebrity funeral. For his own part, young Mario Lewis sported a brand-new, state-of-the-art pseudoloon. His mother had bought this archigrammatical garment for him, and Lucy had spared no expense. The boy was childishly delighted with his fancy getup. The pseudoloon had everything a Mercurian boy could desire: a diamond crystal bubble helmet, a boy-sized life support cuirass, woven nanocarbon arms and legs, plus fashionable accents of silver, copper, gold, and platinum. Mario was quite the little lordling in his pseudoloon. He tended to caper. The crowd of male mourners queued to take the freight elevators to the peak of eternal light.
"Dad?"
said Mario, gripping Pitar's spacesuit gauntlet. "Did Colonel de Blakey ever fight duels?" "Oh, yes," Pitar nodded. "Many duels."
"Martial arts are my favorite subject at the creche," Mario boasted. "I think I could be pretty good at fighting duels."
"Son," said Pitar, "dueling is a serious matter. It's never about how strong you are or how fast you are. Men fight duels to defend points of honor. Dueling supports propriety. You can lose a duel and still make your point. Colonel de Blakey lost some duels, so he had to apologize and politically retreat. But he never lost the respect of his peers. That's what it's all about."
"But, Dad, what if I just beat people up with my baton? Wouldn't they have to do whatever I say?"
Pitar laughed. "That's been tried. It never works out well. Thanks to some covert intrigue, his mother's almost certainly, Mario was allowed into the elevator along with the casket of his revered ancestor. De Blakey's casket was simply his original pioneer spacesuit. This archaic device was so rugged, solid, and rigid that it made a perfect sarcophagus. The old elevator, like the old spacesuit, was stoic and grim. It was crammed with suited gentlemen and boys, veiled behind their faceplates. No one broke the grave solemnity of the moment. At last, the shuddering, creaking trip to the surface was over. Pitar followed the economic news, so he was aware of the booming industrial developments on the surface. But to know those statistics was not the same as witnessing major industry at first hand. What a vista of the machinic phylum!
he felt almost as much sheer wonderment as his 8-year-old son. The cybernetic order, conquering Mercury, algorithmically pushing itself into new performance spaces, it had crisply divided its ubiquity into new divisions of spatial and temporal magnitude. The roads, the pits, the mines, the power plants and smelters, that neatly assembled slag, the great slow factory hulks, the vast caravans of ore-laden packets, the dizzying variety of scampering viabs and a true explosion of chipsets. And at the nanocentric bottom of this semi-autonomous pyramid of computational activism, the smart sand. Amateurs gaped at the giant hulks, but professionals always talked about the smart sand. Entropy struck these machines as it did any organized form. Machines that veered from the wandering Mercurian twilight zone were promptly fried or frozen, yet the broken systemic fragments were always reconstituted later. No transistor, gasket, or screw was ever abandoned. Not one fleck of industrial trash, though the cratered landscape was severely torn by robot mandibles. The human funeral procession marched towards the solemn peak of eternal light. This grandiose polar mountain never passed within solar shadow. The peak of eternal light was the most famous natural feature of Mercury, the primal source of the colony's unfailing energy supply. At the peak's frozen base, which was never lit by the sun, was a great frosty glacier. This glacier was the only source of water on or within the planet. This glacier had been formed over eons by the bombardment of comets. Steam as thin as vacuum had accumulated in this frozen shadow, layering monatomically. Those towering layers of black ice, the product of billions of years, had seemed enough to quench the thirst of a million people. Nothing left of that mighty glacier today but a few scarred ice blocks, slowly gnawed by the oldest machines. The polar glacier had, in fact, vanished to quench the thirst of a million people. This ancient ice had passed straight into the living veins of human beings. This planetary resource was whittled down to a mere nub now. Yet one had to look here to know that. The polar glacier existed in permanent darkness. Only the radar in Pitar's suit allowed him to witness the frightening decline. Most of the men ignored this ghastly spectacle. As for his own son, the boy took no notice at all. The shocking decline in polar ice meant nothing to him. He had never seen the North Pole otherwise. And what had the old man, the dead man, said about that crisis? Ever the visionary, he'd certainly known it was coming. The dead pioneer had said, in his blunt and confrontational way, "We'll just have to go fetch some more ice." So they had done as the dead man said. The people of Mercury had built a gigantic manned spacecraft, a metallic colossus, a ship so vast, so overweening in scale, that it might have been an interstellar colony, were such things possible. Robots had hauled this great golden ark to the launch ramp and sent this gleaming dreadnought hurtling off towards the cometary belt, there to commandeer and retrieve some vast, timeless, life-enhancing snowball. Of course, there had been certain other options, rather than a gigantic, fully manned spacecraft. Simpler, more practical tactics. For instance, thousands of tiny robots might have been launched out in vast streams to go capture a comet. Then, as the comet whirled round and round the blazing, almighty bulk of the sun, the robots could have chipped off small chunks of comet frost and sent those modest packets to the Mercurian surface, at the cost of a few small, fresh craters, nothing much compared with the giant mining pits. Clouds of cometary steam would have arisen, puffs of comet vapor drifting north to freeze onto the original great glacier, there at the base of the peak of eternal light. This would have been a quiet, tedious, patient, and gentle way to replenish the vanished glacier. A nurturing restoration of the status quo.
Mercurian women favored this tactic. But to espouse this idea had some dark implications. It implied strongly that Mercury itself should never have been settled by human beings. Were men worthless? Was that the idea? Why not abolish mankind with all its valor, its honor, its urge to explore, and have Mercury remain a mine pit infested with the mindless and soulless machinic phylum? That idea was blasphemy, and there was no reconciling these factions. The civil division there was as distinct as frozen night and blazing day. This tremendous struggle, a primal issue of resources and politics, had almost broken the colony. As tempers rose, a compromise was urged by certain moderates, whom everyone ignored. Why not just buy some ice, admit that Mercury faced a water crisis beyond its power, and buy ice from foreigners? The asteroids had plenty of ice. What sense did it make to design a weird horde of ice robots? Why create some swaggering Mercurian flagship at such crippling cost? Just abandon honor and autonomy, abandon foolish pride, and pay foreigners. There were merchants out there already, willing to trade for metals, if one could call those weird entities people. After much bloodshed, feuding disgraces, regrettable excesses, the manned explorers had won the Civil War. Why? Because they had claimed the mantle of the traditional values. Then these conservative fanatics had climbed aboard their new golden spacecraft and promptly abandoned Mercury with all its long traditions. The field of honor had settled nothing, thought Pitar, because those traditions were fictions, irrational retrodictions, modern political interpretations of lost historical realities. The values of Colonel de Blakey were much wilder than anyone cared to remember. De Blakey and the men of his generation were fantastic visionaries. De Blakey, the Mercurian hero, cared nothing for colonizing Mercury. He saw Mercury as a mere stepping stone to colonizing the sun. In his arcane 240-year lifespan, this great man had advanced his philosophy in vast scriptural detail, endlessly writing, preaching, planning, designing, and theorizing. Pitar had read a few million of these hundreds of millions of words. Very few ever did. As the mourners gathered in their artificial twilight at the mountain's base, Pitar realized that he was attending the last public airing for de Blakey's great pioneer ideology. Mercurian celebrities delivered their funeral orations, eloquent, careful, and well-considered. Yet de Blakey's titanic legacy was much too large for their tiny gestures. The mourners clearly desired to be brief, for the radiation on the surface made that wise. Yet a lifespan of a quarter of a millennium was no easy thing to summarize. De Blakey's schemes had to do with interstellar settlement, mankind's manifest destiny in the galaxy. Taming the stars, as he put it, such were the progressive visions that racked the great man's brain as the early Mercurian colonists crouched in their stone closets, half-suffocated and sipping toxic comet water. De Blakey was scheming to mine Mercury, fully develop the machinic phylum, and then march gloriously forth to mine the sun, to dwell within the sun, living in eternal light, to thrive in eternal light, without any shadow of any planet's bulk, forever. Because, while Mercury certainly had gold, silver, platinum, and transuranic metals, sometimes scattered on the cratered surface in gleaming pools, the sun possessed every element. Imaginary star readouts would whip through the sun's tenuous atmosphere at a hyper-Mercurian speed, sifting out water, carbon, metals, anything mankind needed, directly from the solar cloud. These visionary sun forts would be vast magnetic bottles, all tractor beams and photon traps with living golden cores. Once mankind had taught the machinic phylum to dwell within the atmospheres of stars, no further limits would ever trouble mankind. Above all, there would be no limits to the settler population. Dutiful women living for centuries would raise and acculturate hundreds of children, each one trained to star-spanning pioneer values. At this singular rate of population explosion, the sun would soon support hundreds of billions of people, trillions of citizens manning millions of colonies. So many colonies, so cybernetically capable, that they would seize command of the sun. With such titanic energy resources, interstellar flight would become a corollary, a mere logical detail. Tamed solar flares would magnetically fling new colonies, hurtling at near-light speed, into the atmospheres of the nearest stars. Any species that could dwell within the stars would swiftly dominate the galaxy, spreading algorithmically, exponentially, resistlessly, galactically. Men who understood this had no need to search for Earth-like planets, that illusion of meager fools. They would dwell forever within the machinic phylum, each superhuman soul a peak of eternal light. There was a certain fierce logic to De Blakey's cosmic plans. If not entirely pragmatic, they were certainly aspirational. Driven by such fierce and boundless human will, the machinic phylum would explode across the universe. However, De Blakey was mortal, and therefore dead. To the serious-minded, sensible people actually living today within the planet Mercury, his dream seemed arcane, far-fetched, absurd. And now, his funeral eulogists were trying to come to terms with all of that, to settle all of that, to bury all of that. They were gently folding this man's wild pioneer dream into the harmless legendary of everyday Mercurian existence. Petar's boy tugged at his gauntleted arms. These high-flown orations had the boy bored stiff.
Dad?
Petar opened a private channel. What is it? Do you need a bathroom? Use the suit.
Dad, can I go fight now? That's Jimmy over there. He likes to fight.
No sparring during funerals, son. Mario grimaced at this reproof. He rubbed exo-atmospheric dust from his diamond bubble helmet.
Dad, when they build a new colony at the South Pole, will we go there?
Mario, there's no water at the South Pole. There are hills of eternal light there, so there's plenty of energy. But fate put no glaciers for us in that place. It's uninhabitable.
But our space heroes will come back someday and bring us a water comet. Then will we go?
Yes, said Petar. We would go. There would be new opportunities there, more than in this old colony. The South Pole would mean a different life, new social principles.
Yes, we would go there.
I would take you with me, and your brothers too, because you'll have brothers someday.
Would Mom go with us?
Son, in 9 years, you'll be married yourself. I'll arrange that. And believe me, that's sure to complicate your agenda.
Mom would go to a new colony. She wants to invent a new way of life. She told me that.
Really?
Yes, she told me. She really means it.
Petar drew a breath within his helmet. We are, after all, a pioneering people. That is our true heritage, and I'm proud that you are witnessing all this. You'll live a very long time, my son. So be sure to remember this day and all it means. This world belongs to you. It was given to you. And don't you ever forget that. Another speaker took the rostrum at the funeral plateau. This elder had to walk with robot assistance, and though he said little enough, he spoke at the droning rate of the very wise, a dreadful thing to hear. Mario could not keep his peace.
Dad, will there be other boys like me at the South Pole?
Petar smiled. Of course there will. A society with no youth has no future. If the people of Earth had sent their children into space instead of just foolish astronauts, they would have spread throughout the worlds. Instead, they sank into their mud. That's not your heritage, because those people have no moral fiber. That's why they don't matter now, and we do. Mario struggled to scratch his nose through his bubble helmet. Of course, this feat was impossible.
Dad, do Earth people stink? Jimmy says they stink.
I've never met one personally, but they do have wild germs in their bellies. Earth people can emit some unpleasant odors, and that's a fact.
Pitar cleared his throat inside his spacesuit.
The Earth people don't care much for us either, mind you. They call us termites.
Termites? Dad, what does that mean?
Termites are subhuman social beasts, wild animals, never properly gardened like our animals.
Dad, how big are termites?
I really don't know. About the size of a house cat, I guess. If some man ever calls you a termite, you slap his face and challenge him, understand? That puts a swift end to that nonsense.
All right, Dad.
Stop chattering now, son. This is the climax. This is the great moment. Bearing their ceremonial staves and halberds, the male elders retreated with slow step from the funeral plateau. Sand rose up in waves below the dead man's catafalque. The smart sand formed itself into one grand, pixelated, seething, pall-bearing wave. An impossible liquid, it reverently rolled up the mountain, bearing the dead man. The catafalque crossed the brilliant twilight zone into eternal light. The robots shifted their solar reflectors in unison. The human crowd fell into dramatic, timeless, deep frozen darkness. Pitar felt his spacesuit shudder, a trembling fit of holy awe. The catafalque gleamed like a chunk of the unseen sun. The dead man's suit ruptured from the brilliant heat. Precious steam burst free. One brief, geyser-like human rainbow, one visionary burst of glorious combustion, spewing like a solar flare. Then the ceremony ended. Though the long Mercurian day had scarcely begun, a spiritual dawn had appeared. Pitar sat on the rim of a sandbox, within the great park of splendid remembrance. To pursue his design labors, Pitar often came to this site to carefully sip cognition enhancers and contemplate the metaphysical implications of monumentality. The task of his generations was one of reconciliation, the achievement of a deeper understanding. This park had been the battlefield where the worst mass clashes of the Civil War had occurred. Bitter, bloody, hand-to-hand struggles between the polarized factions. Some of the colony's best, most idealistic, most public-spirited men, trapped by harsh moral necessity, had beaten each other to death in this cavern. Even women had killed each other in here, when it became clear that the great burden of the ice hunt would impinge on their personal politics. Women fought in feline ambush and in martyr operations. Women killed efficiently, because they never wasted effort grasping at the honors of combat. The Civil War was the closest that the colony had ever come to collapse. Worse than any natural catastrophe, worse than the blowouts, worse than the toxic poisonings. The Great Park of Splendid Remembrance was, by its nature, an ancient Mercurian lava tube. This cavern was a natural feature, unplanned by man, untouched by the jaws of machines. So it was thought, somehow, that this blood-stained space of abject moral failure was best left to wilderness, to living creatures other than mankind. The original settlers had brought genetic material from their homelands on Earth. These vials of DNA had been preserved with care, but never released inside the world, never instantiated as living creatures. Today, the Park of Splendid Remembrance was thick with them. These thriving, vegetal entities had exotic shapes, exotic features, and exotic ancient names. Banyans, jacarandas, palms, elong-elong, papayas, jackfruit, teak, and mahogany. Unlike the homely, useful algae on which the colony subsisted, these woody species took on wild, unheard-of forms. Under the blazing grow lights, rising in the light gravity, rooted in a strange mineral soil, they were the native Mercurian forest. Great, green, reeking, shady, twisted eminences, bizarre organic complexities, flowering gnarling, branching, fruiting. This wilderness mankind had unleashed was not beautiful. It was vigorous, but crabbed and chaotic. It was, as yet, merely a colonial tangle, a strange, self-choking complex of distorted traditional forms. Like all aesthetic issues, thought Pitar, the problem here had its roots within a poor metaphysics. To introduce this ungainly forest, so as to obscure a dark place where human will had failed, that effort was insincere. It had not been thought through. The great park of splendid remembrance had feared to face the whole truth, so it was as yet neither great nor splendid, because it had shrieked the hard thinking required by the authentic Mercurian texture of existence. This was Pitar's own task. Sitting in deep thought, Pitar idly drew squares, triangles, circles within the childish playbox of Smart Sand. With each stroke of his dueling club, the Smart Sand responded and proceeded. Arcane ripples bounded and rebounded from the corners of the sandbox. The computational entities, with which mankind shared this planet, were never intelligent. The machinic phylum, which seemed so clever and vigorous to the untrained eye, was neither alive nor smart. The phylum was merely the phylum. It had no will, no pride, no organic lust for survival, no reason to exist and persist. Without human will to issue its coded commands, the phylum would collapse in an eye blink, returning to the sun-blasted constituent elements of this world. But although the phylum possessed neither life nor intelligence, it did possess an order of being. It was not alive, merely processual, yet it had transcended the natural. The phylum was a metaphysical entity, and worthy of respect. Something like the spiritual respect owed a dead body, a thing. Yes, inert. Yes, of ashes. Yes, yet so much more than mere inert ashes. The truth, beyond intelligence. There were those who said, the daring thinkers of Pitar's own generation, that the sun was self-possessed, not in the old-fashioned, cranky, archaic, heroic way that the visionaries like de Blakey had once imagined. The sun was never alive, nor was the sun intelligent, but the sun was an entity, metaphysically ordered. The sun that loomed over tiny Mercury was one object of the order of a star. And these thinkers speculated. Speculating, furthermore, just as bravely daring as their ancestors, though in a more modern fashion, that there were many orders in the cosmos, life and intelligence and the processual phylum were just three of those countless orders. These speculative realists held that the cosmos were inherently riddled with unnatural orders, hundreds, possibly thousands, of independent, extropic orders, each order unknown to the next, yet each as real and noble as the next, each as important as life or thought. Some orders transpired in picoseconds, other orders in unknowable eons. Orders, each as deep and complex and unnatural as life, or cognition, or computation. Entities, autarkic ontologies, occupying the full panoply of every scale of space-time, from the quantum foam, where space disintegrated, to the forever unknowable scale of the cosmos, forever outside the light cone of any instrumentable knowability. That was reality. There were those who called these idle dreams, but reality was neither idle nor a dream. Much scientific evidence had been carefully amassed to prove the objective existence of extropic orders. Pitar followed Mercurian science with some care, although he never involved himself in the fierce, bloody duels over precedence and citation. Pitar understood the implications of modern science for his own creative work. Any true, sincere monument, any place of genuinely splendid remembrance, would be built in a manner that took reality into a full account, an enlightened peak of moral comprehension. This awareness would transcend awareness. It would respect that ordered otherness in all its many forms and do that otherness honor. It might well take him, thought Pitar,
centuries to come to workable terms with this professional ambition. But since he had that time, it behooved him to spend his time properly. Such was his duty. This was something that he himself could do, to add to all that had passed before, as a legacy to whoever or whatever was to follow. Pitar glanced up, suddenly from the writhing sandpit. His wife had arrived. Lucy was on her bicycle. Pitar mounted his own two-wheeled machine. He rode to join her. Pitar rode smoothly and elegantly, because he'd infested his bicycle's frame with smart sand. He hadn't told his wife about this design gambit. Lucy merely thought, presumably, that he was tremendously good at learning to ride a bicycle. No need to bring up that subject. Enough that he had a bicycle and that he rode it with her. Deeds, not words. His wife's head had fully encased in her black helmet. Her body was almost pseudolooned by her black, flowing bicycle garb. Mounted on her bicycle, Lucy scarcely looked like a woman at all. More of a dark, scarcely knowable, metaphysical object. But, when Pitar wore his own helmet, he was as anonymous and mysterious as she. So, faceless and shameless, they rode together, tires crunching subtly on the park's long gray cinder path.
"Mr. Peretz, you look very thoughtful sitting there in your sandbox."
"Yes," said Pitar, forbearing to nod, due to the bulk of his helmet.
"What were you thinking?"
A deadly female question. Pitar found a tactful parry. "Look here, I have created a new bicycle. See, I'm riding it now."
"Well, yes. I saw that you printed a new bicycle, and it's more advanced now, isn't it? What happened to your nice old bicycle? You rode that one so gallantly."
"I gave that machine to a friend," said Pitar. "I gave it to a Mr. Giorgio Harold de Venet." His wife's front wheel wobbled suddenly.
"What? To him? How? Why? He beat you in a duel."
"It's true that Mr. de Venet is a duelist, and it's true that I lost that duel. But that was 8 years ago, and there's no reason I can't be polite."
"Why did you do that?"
Pitar said nothing.
"Why did you do it? You had some reason for doing that. You should tell me that. He insulted me. I should know this."
"Let's just ride," Pitar suggested. Pitar had given the gift to the duelist because he'd known that there would be trouble about the bicycles. This radical innovation, bicycling, it did damage the institution of Perda. Maybe it did not violate the letter of propriety, but it certainly damaged the spirit. Pitar had been confronted on that issue, politely. So Pitar had, just as politely, referred that matter of honor to Mr. Giorgio Harold de Venet, also the possessor of a bicycle. Mr. de Venet, a brawny and athletic man, was delighted with his new bicycle. As he scorched past mere pedestrians, pedaling in a fury, Mr. de Venet's strength and speed were publicly displayed to fine effect. Skeptics had questioned Mr. de Venet's affection for bicycles. He had promptly forced them to retract their assertions and apologize. In this fashion, the matter of bicycles was settled. Mr. de Venet was not so punctilious, however, that he had escaped being seen in the flirtatious bicycling company of the notorious Widow de Schubert. She was the type who rode through life without a helmet. The widow's late husband, outmatched and sorely lacking in tact, had already fallen on the field of honor. To own a bicycle was not the same as understanding its proper use. At the rate that matters progress these days, it wouldn't be long before Mr. de Venet joined the other victims of the Widow de Schubert. The duelist could batter any number of bicycle skeptics, but to defeat a woman's wiles was far beyond his simplicity. Men who lived by the club fell by the club, a trouble story far older than this world. Pitar was at peace with these difficult facts of life. The notorious Widow de Schubert was one of his wife's best trusted friends, but he did not inquire into that tangled matter, Certain things between men and women were best left unspoken. His wife lifted her visor by a thumb's width so as to be better heard.
"Mr. Peretz, I do enjoy these new outings that we have together nowadays. You have given me another gift that I long desired. For that, I am grateful to you. You are a good husband."
"Thank you very much for that kindly remark, Mrs. Peretz. That's very gratifying.
Are you pleased by our situation today?"
Given the praise he had just received, Pitar ventured a candid response. "Although modernity has some clear advantages," he told her, "I can't say it's entirely easy. And that very modest bicycle garb, I cannot see your face. In fact, I can't see anything of you at all. You are a deep mystery."
"Beneath this black garment, sir, I wear nothing but my beautiful golden Mangal Sutra. I feel so free nowadays, freer than I have ever felt as a modern woman."
Pitar pondered this provocative remark. It had emotional layers and textures closed to mere men. "That's an interesting data point there."
"Mr. Peretz, although it was not our own will that united us," Lucy said, rolling boldly on, "I feel that marriage is an important exploration of a woman's emotional phase space. Someday, we too, separated of course, will look back on these years with satisfaction. You in your way, and me in mine, as that must be. Nevertheless, we will have accomplished a crucial joint success."
"You're full of compliments this afternoon, Mrs. Peretz. I'm glad you're in such a good mood."
"This is not a question of my so-called moods," his wife told him. "I am trying to explain to you that now that we possess bicycles, modernity is achieved. It's time that I faced futurity. And to do what futurity requires from me, I will need your help. It's time we built another child."
"Since honor requires that of me as well, Mrs. Peretz, I can only concur."
"Let's build a daughter this time."
"A daughter would be just and fair."
"Good.
Then that's all settled.
These are good times. A good day to you, sir."
She bent to heave at her whirring pedals, and she rapidly wheeled away.
The End. We hope you have enjoyed this production of Edge of Infinity, edited by Jonathan Strawn, narrated by Ramon Diocampo, Anil Margzahayam, Susan Nizami, Adenrale Ojo, Chris Sorensen, Laura Waddell, and Michael Welsh. Recorded books are available wherever audiobooks are sold, including Audible.com, Audiobooks.com, Google Play, Apple iTunes, and in public libraries through RB Digital. Thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.